This podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence. It is not appropriate for children.
So we got him out of bed and he was just a crying, bumbly mess, you know. So it was good, this big, strong coward was crying like a baby when he was arrested.
Heath O'Loughlin is an Australian author whose new book, Sons of God, is about a topic very close to his heart, the Victorian Special Operations Group. It's special to Heath because his father, Doug, was a founding member. This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the headlines to discover how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next. In this episode, we'll hear about sieges, stabbings, hostage situations and terror attacks from the perspective of a man whose job it was to deal with them all. And from his son, whose childhood was spent wondering if his dad would make it home. We kick off this conversation by asking Doug O'Loughlin about SOG basic training.
Yeah, he went through the training course, which was the hardest course ever.
They all say that.
What was hard about it, by the way? What's the training?
Oh, just the physical training and, yeah, it was very demanding on you mentally and physically.
In my imagination, I'm thinking of those movies and TV shows where, what, did they put a hood over your head and pretend to kidnap you in the middle of the night or something and dump you in the middle of the desert?
Like, no, they did that to Heath when he was 15. Yeah. It's just the aspect of it, because you're looking for individual men that won't give up. But you're also looking for team players. There must be a team player. You can't go into a situation, a hostage siege situation, where you want to be the hero or you want to do everything. You must rely on your teammates that are following you in or you're following them in. So, yeah, it's the team dynamics is so important to make sure that you come out on top.
Do the glory seekers get weeded out pretty quickly? Like, because you always think, people would be attracted to that. It's
elite. Yeah. Well, it is an attractive job for somebody that wants a little bit different in their policing. And, but if you want to be the individual and want to be the hero, you won't last very long at all.
So there's this dynamic there that the instructors that I've spoken to, the former SOG guys who were putting these inductees through their paces, they acknowledge their job was to break them. Whether it was physically or mentally, that was their job, to break them. So they'd identify strengths of a certain person, whether it be his physical strength or his mental strength or the fact that he was a great runner, and they would avoid letting him play to his strengths. They would find out what his weakness is and play to that weakness, and they would just drill him on it until he breaks. And there was, you know, stories about guys doing 1,000 push-ups or 1,000 sit-ups and the instructor saying, just keep going, and this guy crying, let me stop. No, you keep going. They didn't care if they couldn't quite push out the full push-up. They just wanted to see that they'd keep going because, as Dad rightly said, the SOG is the last resort. There's nothing after the SOG. So if the SOG fails, that's it.
I'd be done after 10 push-ups. So I would never make it.
Doug, what was your strength and what was your weakness? What did they drill you on?
I suppose physically, I hate running. Oh. And so, yeah, we'd go on long runs and things like that. So I don't mind the gym work and things like that, but running, I do it, but I don't like it.
Did you have a bit of a cry? Some
men that you'd be running with, they'd be running backwards and talking to you, and I just shut up.
Please stop talking.
Leave me alone.
Yeah. Did you ever have a sook when you were running because you hated it?
One day there we had to do a 20-mile forced march in our full gear, and we were out the back of Little River walking there with our full gear and everything, and that was pretty hard. And we were all physically, we had blisters, we were physically stuffed at the end of it. That night we had to go and raid a house for the neo-Nazis, and where a shooting occurred, where one of them was killed. We were so physically stuffed, and yet all of a sudden here's this operation. And what was the benefit of doing that 20-kilometre march other than, yes, I've done it, I completed it? who's going to give up, I suppose.
But it's sending you into a job depleted.
That's like dangerous.
Well, they wouldn't have known that that job was coming up night.
Right.
So, but all of a sudden, there it is, you know. So you think, well, is that so important that you're not physically, maybe not physically ready for the job?
On the intake process, you have these situations where you have up to 120, 130 men and women these days trying out to join the SOG. Mm-hmm. And by the end of the entire process, maybe four get through.
Ooh. Wow.
So that probably shows you how brutal it is and how special the guys in the SOG are.
Well, you want the best, don't you? Because if it's a last resort, I want protection.
When you say it's a last resort, it is as far as policing is concerned. But if it was a terrorist incident, of course you have the SAS that would come across, or the commandos from New South Wales. But again, that's maybe 8-12 hours before they get here, get organised and ready to take over.
Can we look at this Wantirna raid as a case study? Do you remember much about that?
I was at a I just read a little bit about it, and I knew someone who knew a bit about it. It's funny you mention it.
Well, it's funny too because Doug goes more. He just looks at Heath. He thinks he remembers more of it than I do. And you weren't there, Heath.
Obviously, all the details are in the book, course, about this particular job. But essentially, you had a group of men out there, pretty nasty men. That one of them was obsessed with Adolf Hitler. And formed a little group with a three or four other guys, and they became a bit of a neo-Nazi sort of cult. And they were also obsessed with the Special Operations Group, funnily enough, and they started training to knock off the SOG. They thought that if they could build up their abilities and capabilities with weapons and tactics, that let's take this supposed best group in the country, let's take them on. They started doing all sorts of nasty things like bombing some cars, bombing some buildings, shootings, robberies. They stole lots of weapons from museums. They just needed to find guns. Mm. So they were raiding museums. They were doing bank jobs. But what happened was that the detectives were all over them, and the SOG was eventually called in to raid houses, and they raided several houses to try and get all the members in one fell swoop. What ended up happening was that they went into one of their houses where they thought the two kingpins were, and one of the guys was ready for the SOG. He had the gun stuffed under the pillow and another one right near his bed. I think it was an M1 carbine, which is a seriously powerful rifle, and a shooting, you know, like a gunfight ensued inside a house. This guy had his wife in the house
suburbia? This is like...
Yeah, Wantirna.
It's like in the outer east. It's kind of... Would have been a newish suburb back then, wouldn't it?
Yeah, probably back then. So, you know, you had this situation where there was a shooting, and as most of the cases, the SOG wins.
I would think so. Mm. I would think so. I wouldn't pit myself against them.
But in that shooting, one of the men was hit twice with rounds into his ballistic vest. So
into his body, into his abdomen.
And so within that book, I speak to that particular member that got shot twice, and he talks me through what was going through his mind, how it all unfolded, you know, when he's kicking in a door of a house 1 minute and then suddenly just seeing these orange sparks from a gun coming from a dark bedroom, because this is happening at like 3 a.m.
Yeah.
He's being shot at suddenly and everything changes, snap of the fingers. So he talks me through what his next moves were, what he did next, and how it all sort of unfolded. And it's remarkable stuff when you're getting this sort of first-hand account from these guys that have never spoken before about it.
There's another one where the member went into a room and a bloke had a go at him with a machete and you missed, you know, and so they grab him, put him down and that, and then when he went to communicate on his radio to say, you know, it's all safe to come in to meet the officers and that, he found out that he couldn't communicate because he's... earplug and the cord running down to the radio from his ear had been slashed and across his vest. So the bloke had actually got him.
Wow.
But didn't hurt him.
But very nearly got his throat.
A little bit higher.
A couple of inches, yeah.
So they're the sorts of things that people think, oh, you know, it's pretty easy to do. You look how they're all geared up and they've got all the equipment. etc. But it's still very dangerous. And
I've never thought it was really easy to do. Like, who thinks that?
So you try to make sure that everything's on your side. So there's a lot of planning goes into doing raids and things like that. And yeah, and you make sure that you've got superiority in numbers and weapons, etc.
Well, one of the very few coppers I know who's still married and retired is Ron Idles.
Yeah.
And he talks about the value of the fact that his wife was a mental health nurse. They're still married. She's retired. And he made the decision and he came home and told her everything. And so that gave him that debrief that so many coppers don't have in their lives because they don't want to burden their loved ones with it.
The pub often.
Yeah.
Some people have said to Linda, how did you stay married for so long?
Yes. Because it's unlike, we're very used to the narrative of police marriages breaking up. Yeah. So you and Linda still together?
Yes.
They're still asking her though.
Still asking her how she's doing it. How on earth are you doing this, Linda? Did you talk to her?
48? Yeah, she knew and talked a little bit, but not not in great detail, no.
But you have to say that the wives and partners I've played such an enormous part. Like I look back at what my mum was able to do for myself and my older brother Ben in terms of keeping that family unit solid because, you know, when Dad's pager went off back then, you know, in the early 80s, it was a pager and then obviously the mobile phone, but that pager went off and everything stopped.
Yep.
Like our whole lives revolved around that pager and obviously for Dad, and we understand it, but that was priority number one in a lot of ways because we just had to come to terms with the fact that someone else needed Dad more than we did, that his expertise was needed to maybe save some other kids from someone that may have, you know, got them at gunpoint or, you know, an angry father that wanted to lay siege to his house with his wife and kids inside. So
was it mostly in the middle of the night the pager went off? That's something that...
It's usually late, but it could be any time.
Right.
Like, I mean, but we just knew that when Dad left, I suppose, and from Mum, like she just never knew if he was coming back because he also wasn't allowed to say where he was going, what he was going to do.
Early in the piece, yeah, it was very secretive, too much so. But I couldn't say to Linda, you know, all she knew I was going on a job. I might be away for 3 days.
Oh, gosh.
She wouldn't know where I was or what. The only time she could get any information was to watch the news. Something on the news, and then she'd be yelling at them to keep quiet so she could find out what's going on. But, you know, it was silly, but you weren't allowed to make phone calls and all that sort of business.
That to me sounds like the way I imagine having a husband off at war in the 40s.
Mm, yeah.
When you don't know from one second to the next if he's still alive and you're waiting for news either for him to roll up or for someone else to roll up. I wish Linda was here because I want to know about her mental health during that time.
So do we.
During that time and now. Does she ever talk about that? Did she ever need counselling to deal with that stress?
Not so much counselling, no, but she needed to talk to some people and I suppose she did.
She had some good friends around her as well, but I mean, extremely stoic and staunch, my mum.
Tough hombres, these parents of yours.
Yeah, and that was just the life, you know. Like I suppose back then you just dealt with it, you know, just day by day. Oh, Doug's gone again or Dad's out again and when's he coming back? We don't know. So because you got these two young kids, Mum just had to try and keep things as normal as possible. We still got to go to school. We still got to play our basketball and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, it just was when Dad's home, he's going to be home and then it all goes back to normal again. It's just, I suppose I'm 1 year old when Dad joined, so I didn't know any different up until 18.
I remember one night coming home and she was quite upset that I'd come home because she'd cooked four lamb chops, one each for the boys and two for her. She had to share.
When did you realise that Dad had a dangerous job? Like what Dad did?
I think in my teens, I was so fascinated by the police force. And again, going back to the family situation, you know, Dad's one of 8 kids, 5 brothers, all 5 boys joined the police force.
No way.
Climbed right through the ranks to.
Why was that? Was your dad in the force?
No, Dad was a bootmaker. So just one brother joined in 1957, then another one joined, another one in the 60s, then my brother immediate to me. He joined and I'd already been a cadet, so Okay. Yeah, it was just...
So it's the family business by the time you come on.
Yeah, it's the family business, and I was intrigued, but less so my brother Ben, actually, which is funny because he's now a policeman. But when I was 16 or 15, work experience, Dad let me do work experience with the SOG. So I spent 2 weeks. When Dad filled out my my performance sheet, and this is the hard marker, the SOG, I got... mine was satisfactory, where all the other kids returned with excellent, excellent. All the boxes I got ticked from Dad.
Oh my God. Satisfactory. It was a satisfactory
card. He said you have to do something pretty extraordinary to get excellent.
Wow. Yeah.
And I clearly
it's the
didn't.
Same with his book. He said, what do you think of the book? I said, satisfactory.
Oh my God. Hey, if you've got Stockholm syndrome, I don't know. You don't understand how hard your upbringing was, man.
Yeah, I think so. You're touching on your point about when I sort of started to realize what Dad did. There was another situation where Mum and I, and Dad, I don't know where Ben was, but we were at Dad's sister's place down in Mornington, Red Hill.
Yeah.
And it was a family gathering, and Dad got the call out, and it was probably about 9 p.m. We were probably set to leave anyway. And this particular job was on the Mornington Peninsula, quite close. So we had to go there with Dad to a siege situation and sit in the car until 1 a.m., you know, like at the command post, while Dad and the men are preparing to sort of raid this place and get this gunman out. So Mum and I are in the car until 1 o'clock in the morning, and Dad eventually realised that this was probably going to drag on to maybe 9 a.m. or something. So he got a uniformed police officer to drive us home to Eltham.
We have got to talk to Linda. We have got to get her in here.
We need a special ladies episode.
I am fascinated by your mum, Heath. Yes. What a woman. Sitting in the car with the kids.
I also knew, started to find out that Dad had shot someone and was shot at, but he would never ever give me the details until now, which has been a fascinating thing as well to sort of go through what happened there. And then talking to these guys about what goes through their mind after they've shot someone was...
Well, I feel the need now to ask. Doug, have you killed someone?
No.
Just shot them. Just winged them.
Yeah.
Winged them. Yeah.
Are you able to expand on that experience?
No, the experience afterwards is the what ifs, you know. What if he hadn't have come out, and what if we had have gone in, and what if we'd used gas and things like that? Mm-hmm. So you're sort of trying to think, you know, could you have done something different? Well, in the circumstances, we couldn't, because he'd fired at us, and part of the shot that he let go had actually brushed through the pants of one of the SOG members. So we were all pretty lucky. But that gentleman was mentally unstable in that. In some regard, sort of glad that he wasn't killed.
It's so interesting you say that, because in a previous episode we talked to the family of a young woman who was mentally ill, and she was brandishing a knife one night at home, and they called the doctor and said, what do we do? And they said, call the police. And the family's first reaction was, the police shoot mentally ill people with knives.
That was their perception. No,
again, everything is a last resort.
They don't go there
with that intention.
No, they called the police, and the police came and were wonderful. Yep. But that was their fear, because this idea is out there that sometimes that has to happen.
Yeah. Oh, of course, especially if someone's coming at you with a knife. And you remember that if someone's 40 feet away with a knife and you've got your gun in your holster and that, by the time you get the gun out of your holster, which would take about 1.5 seconds, he's on top of you with the knife. Mm. And if you see some of the photos from the United States where somebody, a policeman, has been slashed with a knife, it's knife's just as dangerous as anything else.
And to prove that point, Dad and the guys in the SOG actually took a lot of people out to their training ground to show them. And one of the people that they took out once was I hope I'm allowed to mention his name, Neil Mitchell from 3RW.
Yeah, sure.
Took Neil out because Neil is obviously so vocal in the current affairs space, and he was very critical of police that had shot people with knives. So, righto, Neil, come out and actually experience it for yourself. So they gave Neil a texter, texted with the lid off, so you can actually show if you can strike someone with that texter and make a mark on their clothing.
Yes.
Before.
It's a good simulation.
Yeah, it's a good simulation. So you try and get to the gunman before he shoots you. Let's see who wins. And the guy with the knife that might have been, 10, 15 metres away or whatever, inevitably wins.
Coming up, Doug talks us through the arrest of Melbourne's other famous Minogue siblings Craig and Rodney, who were convicted in 1986 of bombing Melbourne's Russell Street Police Building, killing Constable Angela Taylor. And find out how I got to this place in my life.
That's not even a decision for me. I'm shooting him.
That's coming up in Australian True Crime.
The hardest thing was the kindergarten siege. Was
1989. In Hawthorne.
Mm. No matter what we were going to do to try and resolve that situation, possibly one of the children would get hurt.
Oh, my God.
Can you tell us about that so listeners know the sort of background about it?
Well, it's some man that was – he had problems with a hospital the treatment of his wife, and he wanted compensation, all sorts of things. He was outside Parliament and everything like that. But eventually he was looking for a solicitor's office, and I think he went into a kindergarten and took four children, I think it was, and locked himself, nailed up a toilet and stayed in there, spread petrol around, splashed the kids with petrol. So without sort of going into great detail because it's all in the book, in that situation, we tried to talk him out. We thought eventually we were thinking about he kept sticking his head up. So do we pop him? If we shoot him, he falls down on the kids. Kids got blood. Blah blah blah. No, you can't do that.
It's not ideal.
Can we crash the door in? Mm-hmm. We crash the door in. We injure one of the kids. Blah.
So it's a no-win situation, isn't it?
Yeah, and Dad's in charge of this situation as well, and the pressure on him because all the parents are now coming to the kindergarten wanting to know, is my kid in there? What are you doing? And, you know, this one drags out for 7.5 hours.
Mm. And, you know, it was funny. We're offering him some food and that, and he said, well, what about some lollies for the kids? And a little kid said, I want a lolly. Oh, my God.
Poor little darlings. Kids are kids. Man, Serafettin Hussein, was imprisoned in 2014, incidentally, for attacking his wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so after he got out of jail, he then reoffended. Yeah.
Yeah.
With a hammer or something.
With a tomahawk, I think, or something like that. But, you know, again, speaking to the guys that were at that scene, and they were so mad, you know, they had to keep their emotions in check. We've got a job to do. We can't let the fact that this guy's got these little four-year-olds in this cubicle affect us because we just have a job to do. But in terms of the petrol, these guys were ill themselves from sitting outside the toilet cubicle from the fumes. They wanted to, you know, vomit because the fumes were so strong. So you can imagine what these little kids go through. And I look at that when I was writing that chapter and I think Dad's in charge of this whole thing. So that goes pear-shaped. Who are they going to point the finger at? They're going to point the finger at him.
And hard.
Yeah.
I mean, if that had gone wrong, God, your face would have been on.
Naturally, it's why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? You know, did you think about doing this?
The armchair pundits. Over that.
But even taking that shot, maybe the spark ignites the petrol and the whole thing goes up like an incinerator. So
I can't imagine that pressure. Like, I'm feeling stressed listening to that scenario. I can feel my chest tightening.
Another one where Dad, you definitely told me this story, but you can't remember it. Christmas morning.
Yeah.
So again, we're at home. We don't have Dad there because Dad's out at a job where a guy had taken his whole family hostage because he split with his wife and he had no access to the kids, and all he wanted to do was see his kids on Christmas morning. He wanted to be there when they woke up. So Dad, thinking outside the square, gets his men to start piffing rocks at the kids' windows to wake the kids up early. Guy sees his kids in the morning, siege over, he surrenders.
Oh, hang on. So where was the guy?
He's inside the house.
He's inside the house with a gun. The kids are still asleep.
Kids are asleep. He's basically laid siege to the house. He's got his wife in there and he's saying that I'm not leaving until I see my kids in the morning for Christmas.
Great. Let's let him see the kids and see if he'll be happy with that and
Dad
come out.
Dad tells his men that have got the house surrendered. He's thinking, all right, I reckon we can end this a bit early. Let's wake the kids up. Gets his men to start piffing rocks at the kids' windows to wake the kids up early. Guy sees his kids in the morning, siege over, he surrenders.
Oh, hang on. So where was the guy?
He's inside the house.
He's inside the house with a gun. The kids are still asleep.
Oh, kids are asleep. He's basically laid siege to the house. He's got his wife in there and he's saying that I'm not leaving until I see my kids in the morning for Christmas.
Great. Let's let him see the kids and see if he'll be happy with that and
Dad
come
tells
out.
His men that have got the house surrendered. He's thinking, all right, I reckon we can end this a bit early. Let's wake the kids up. So he's throwing stones at the windows to try and wake the kids up, and, you know, worked perfectly. So
it did. He saw the kids and said, all right,
and came out.
Yep.
Because I'm thinking that's potentially dangerous that the kids have gone from unaware and asleep to now involved.
Mm.
But that's a decision you have to make in the moment to try and save everyone's lives.
Yeah. Again, you look for every opportunity, every avenue to resolve something peacefully.
Mm. So much psychology involved.
And the strategic thinking would be so intense.
A little bit.
I love how you and go quiet while we all go, oh, but Doug! And you're just like, yep.
Then they obviously dealt with a lot of people that wanted to go out suicide by cop as well, which, again, there's a whole other layer of someone that actually wants you to shoot them.
Wow.
And there was, you know, times where these people would come out and one kid whose father had actually gone out suicide by cop and he wanted to follow his father's footsteps for whatever reason, comes out of a house and they finally talked him out of the house, but he came out with his hand up his jumper and he's coming out to a semicircle of SOG guys walking straight towards him with his hand up his jumper. And you're thinking, you know, right now you've got split second decision to make here. Has this kid got a handgun under that jumper? And he quickly whips out the hand as if to get the SOG guys to shoot. So these are situations that these guys are confronting all the time.
Well,
and
to
they
be
have
honest,
to make those decisions.
That's not even a decision for me. I'm shooting him.
Well,
when he comes out and I think it's possible, I'm just shooting him.
Early in my career in the SOG, we raided a house for a man wanted for murder. And so we raided the house, went in, entered into the bedroom. And as we entered the bedroom, he sat bolt upright in bed and pointed his hand like he had a gun at us. And talking to my colleague that was with me, we were both a fraction of a second off shooting him because we naturally you think, God, he's got a gun.
You look for the hands too, don't you?
Yeah, you look for the hands because hands kill. And in that split second, we realised he didn't. But imagine if we had have shot him and dead and trying to explain that we shot this man, unarmed man.
Because he held up his hand.
And there's a lot of
you're right
nuances about that that the public just don't understand. Like,
no, that's when we go, you're trigger happy, you're crazy, macho. Yeah.
And the other one, Michelle, on that is that when all, like you might have, say, that semicircle situation that I was saying, so you've got this guy surrounded, the kid that came out from the house. If they all react, they all see the same thing, these SOG guys. So there might be five of them. And if they all fire at the same time.
Yeah, then it's heavy-handed.
You're talking like maybe 15, 16, 18 shots.
Yeah.
And that's where you get the people or the public coming out saying, how could you have shot someone 18, 20 times? It's like, well, five of us all went bang, 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 bang.
And he was not armed and...
Or if he was armed and
yeah,
it just
you're
looks
right.
excessive.
Even, yeah.
It looks excessive, but it's not because it's split-second decisions. Yeah. And it's, as one of the guys says, if you have to shoot once only, then maybe you shouldn't have shot. Wow. If your life is under threat, you should probably let off a few, like at least,
okay.
Because you wanna cancel that
threat,
negate the threat, and make sure that there's no more. So it's not just a case of one shot, like in the movies, and you know, like a tap to the head.
Mm.
It's several shots to make sure that that person's going to go down and stay down, and that the gun or the knife or whatever's out of their reach, and they're not going to be able to grab it.
Doug, when you shot someone, do you remember that second, like? Does your training just kick in and you're not actually thinking? Is it instinctive or is there, are you thinking, am I doing this? Yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes. Like are you?
Well, they say, there's a saying, in a crisis under stress, you instinctively revert to the way that you've been trained.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the training kicks in and there's the threat and so you have to deal with it.
And you do it.
Yeah.
What did you think in the immediate aftermath of that? Do you think... oh, my God, are they all right? Or, oh, my God, this is going to be a complete nightmare dealing with
yeah, you wonder, you know, oh, God, have I done the right thing? Yeah. Yeah, and then you realise that you have, yeah.
The Russell Street bombing is an event that's considered a day that changed Australia, changed Australian policing. It was an act of domestic terrorism.
Yep.
And I believe you were involved in arresting at least one suspect.
Yeah, the two brothers, Minogue's, yeah.
Talk us through that.
Well... we found out we raided a house in...
Russell Street, I should say for listeners who are unaware, was the police station.
Russell's police
station. Well, Dad was there when that went off.
Right, you were at headquarters in Russell Street when the bomb went off.
Yeah, I was around the corner talking on the phone and the blast came around the corner into Mackenzie Street, shook the windows I was at and smash one in the next office.
And a young female officer was killed.
So then I was immediately out onto the street to, you know, sort of do what I could. But, yeah, we got information from one of the offenders at Stan Taylor in Witchy Proof as to where the Minogues were. Obviously, the detectives had done a lot of work and worked out who had committed the bombing. And so we flew by helicopter to Swan Hill, and they were in a hotel room. So we got the key to the room and quietly opened the door and grabbed them. And there was a bag full of guns in the room, which one of them, the other, what's
Craig.
The
name? Craig, Craig and Rodney.
Rodney went to go for but was stopped. And Craig was, we got him out of bed and he was just a crying, bumbly mess, you know. So it was good, this big, strong coward was crying like a baby when he was arrested.
So I'm just imagining this from the perspective of the receptionist, by the way, at the Swan Hill Motor Inn, or wherever this
hotel
is,
manager,
right?
Yeah.
So you're just going about your business, and what happens? And a guy in all in black and the chest shield and everything comes in and says,
rings the bell at 3 a.m. in the morning, wakes him up and says, "You got a key to room 16, please?"
Yeah. Is that how it goes down?
Yeah, roughly, yeah.
I'd be asking that question.
No.
On our way there, the detectives would go and get a key at some other stage. So you use a lot of support.
Yeah. Right, I love that story because you still imagine the SOG, you're always kicking doors in and someone actually went, "Oh, we can just get a key."
We just get a key, yeah, totally. In we go.
So, yeah.
You make it sound very low key, but yeah.
Now very bad men too.
He does.
They were very bad men.
To hear that he was crying like a baby when you were arrested.
Yeah, well, we love that. And I can see you love that, Doug. You have a little smirk on your face when you tell us that.
It's funny. There's a really good analogy that one of the guys told me. Again, I work at the North Melbourne Football Club as well, so he's probably talking to me in AFL terms. He said the belief within the SOG was as if you're going out to play, if you were the North Melbourne Football Club and you're going to play the under-13s or 14s Hurst Bridge side. We were so, you know, him talking here, we were so well-trained. We're elite. We're the best in the business. They actually felt sorry for the criminals that they were about to go and hit.
You have a confidence when you're going in.
Yeah, they had no chance. And so I think about these guys, the SOG, thinking, geez, how scared are you about you kick that door in? Mm. They're fighting over who goes first. That was actually a thing that they were, a badge of honour to say, "I'm the entry man. I'm going in first." And they say that's where the action is. So you want to be up the front because you want to put your skills to the test. Yeah. Like a football player wants to be in the team.
Yeah, you're right. I'm imagining it's like, what's on the other side of that door and these big scary bandits.
They're loving the fact that if they missed out on a call up for a job, they were so annoyed. Or if it was a day off when a job that they were working on went off, I was so annoyed. I missed that job.
I missed the Minogues.
Yeah.
What about the Armaguard heist at Tullamarine? What happened there?
I was there the week before.
Uh-huh. So he missed it. So he's spewing.
Oh, spewing. Yeah,
it's a touchy subject.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Heath, you'll have to talk us through
this. Yeah, I can see. So obviously you've got a situation there where some guys held up a Bramble security guard in Port Melbourne first, and they're just sort of warming themselves up to do a bigger and better job. And the armed robbery squad back then as one of the detectives said, we were on them like white on rice. They were all over them, you know, surveillance and the like. And they pulled the SOG in because they knew these guys were some serious criminals that were going to, you know, use guns and do a pretty heavy sort of robbery. So they had the Melbourne airport terminals sort of surrounded, watching these guys for a couple of months. They kept having some false starts. So they'd go to do this job and then they'd stop. And then they'd go the next week and then they'd stop. So it was probably becoming a bit frustrating for the SOG and the ARS, the armed robbery squad at the time. A lot of resources, a lot of money being poured into this job, but they persisted. And the day that it all went off, you had three armed bandits, Normie Lee, Stephen Barchi and Stephen Asling, committing a crime where they were going to try and steal what they thought was $2 million out of an armor guard truck that was dropping off some valuables and cash to a terminal. It ended up being $1.025 million, I think, that they got. The situation was that they ran in, they did the robbery, they steal these bags of cash, they're armed. There's photos of the whole thing. And they ran into the SOG who were waiting for them. And instead of giving up, they decided to pull their guns and point them at the SOG, and one of them shot at the SOG. One died. One was shot several times and ended up dying three times on the way to hospital, but he's still alive today.
Wow.
And that was a huge situation. It was in public, you know, that was right mm-hmm. in the public eye. So mm-hmm. that was a pretty significant
story. And again, it's terrifying. It's the sort of thing that people later can go, you know, what were you doing pulling off an operation like that in public? Yeah. You could have hit bystanders.
That's right, yeah.
Who's the criminal that said that he won't do a job in Victoria?
Christopher Binns. Christopher Badness Binns.
I saw him in court once. He was really crazy.
All right.
But not crazy enough to do a job. True.
Well,
in
yeah. The story there was that the SOG had arrested him once. He was in Victoria, which was rare, and they'd picked him up. I think it was out in Jamison, and when they got him back, or Daylesford, and they got him back in one of the SOG because this guy's so bad, right? The SOG had to sit with him in the cell because he'd broken out of other facilities in the past, so they couldn't have any risk at all. And this SOG guy sitting there with him, and he says, "Hey, mate, how come we don't see you down here in Victoria very often?" And Christopher looks at him and says, are you crazy? Like, I'm never going to do a job here in Victoria because you guys are mad. And he's talking about the SOG. Like, he's scared of the SOG. It's like, no, I'll do my stuff interstate because they're not as bad as you guys. You guys are crazy.
You guys are crazy.
The badness, isn't it? Yeah. Badness.
How do you retire from this life, Doug? How on earth do you...
Well, yeah, for me to be promoted, I had to make a choice of either moving on or staying in the SOG. So the natural thing is to be promoted. So eventually I became a superintendent and ended up at the forensic services and in charge of all the crime scene. And I did the bushfires, the 2009 bushfires.
Wow.
Because I was the disaster victim identification commander, so responsible to the coroner and to the investigation to recover the bodies and things
like
that.
I have a friend who lives in Kinglake, and I went up a week after the fire to take her food and batteries. Remember, the mountain was cordoned off. No one could get up there, but she could come down and get me. So mm-hmm. I met her there with batteries and all that. They had no electricity. And that was traumatic for me, seeing the spots on the road where the cars had been burnt out. And also there was a system, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there were blue police ribbons on gates signified that there was body inside?
Yeah.
The property?
They marked them, yes.
So as we were driving back up to her house, we would pass the gates that had the blue ribbons on them. And it was just, I've never gotten over it myself.
No.
How do you cope?
Well, being in charge of it, of course, I saw some of the devastation and that, but it's the crime scene disaster victim identification unit out at Forensic that do all the work and collect all the bodies and things like that. So going through that and doing it day after day, and they deal with it. It's great how their psychology to doing the job, because it's just a job, so to speak. But it's the next day when they see a photo in the paper of a child that was killed in the fires, and that sort of gets to them a little bit. So, yeah, you've got to just be careful. But
I was a reporter on Lilydale and Yarra Valley Leader at the time of Black Saturday, and we drove through Steeles Creek the week after, and just the smell and and we spoke to a lot of people who had post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we look to you guys to be stoic and get us through moments like that and do the grunt work.
Yeah, well, there's talk at the moment. There's a lot of some mental health issues within the police force. And that's,
a lot of talk about PTSD at the moment.
Yeah, and the chief commissioner is right onto it, and they're doing what they can to help people.
Do you have any, do you think? Do you have any PTSD?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. That response is what you get. One of the guys I spoke to shot an 18-year-old knife-wielding offender, saw him at the end of his bed that night standing there. And, he had that, I think it's awakening vision or whatever they call them. Mm. But most of the guys that I spoke to have that sort of justification of what they did, that they know they didn't do anything wrong, they were just doing their job and they did all the right things. Yeah. And they know that if you start having doubts, that's when things can haunt you and you start second-guessing yourself.
It's incredible psychological tenacity. Mm. And I guess that goes back to the training period, right? This is what we're looking for.
Naturally, I've had a few, what if we'd done this or what if we'd done that? But no, we did it how we had to do it or how it panned out. sometimes you've got no choice because it's the offender or the person you're trying to deal with that causes the situation. So
doesn't human frailty even just freak you out sometimes? Don't you sometimes just think, God, that could be my son, that could happen to him, that could happen to my wife? Human frailty doesn't scare you when you see it that closely?
No.
Doug's not the deep. He's not the deepest thinker, Michelle. You may have picked up. He's very black and white. It's very black and white.
That's probably why.
That's why he was good at what he did.
That's the unshakable former SOG, Doug O'Loughlin, whose son Heath has written an excellent book about the Australian SOG. That is the Special Operations Group for We Civilians. The book is entitled Sons of God, and it's available now. Don't forget you can also buy Emily's excellent books on our Facebook page by hitting the Shop Now button. And, of course, if you want to help other people find this podcast, you can go to iTunes and give us an excellent review and 5 stars. Thank you so much to everyone who's done that already. And thank you to you for downloading Australian True Crime.